I looked for a newspaper job. I went one day to the Trenton Times, and I wasn't even allowed to see anybody. They just handed me a job application. And I said, well, there's no reason to play this straight. And the first question was, what was your last employment? So I said, you know, working on a farm. And they asked, what were your duties? And I said, picking cherries, baling hay, milking cows. And they said, why'd you leave your last employment? And I said, I got tired of stepping in cow shit. I just made a joke of it and went home thinking, well, that's that. And the next day, the feature editor called me, said she wanted me to come in for an interview.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with Thomas Swick, whose book Falling Into Place, A Story of Love, Poland, and the Making of a Travel Writer comes out this week. I quote Tom's previous book, The Joys of Travel, in five different parts of my latest book, The Vagabond's Way. His new book recounts his path toward becoming a travel writer while living in Poland during the anti-authoritarian social movement known as Solidarity in the early 1980s. Together, we talk about what it's like to move overseas for love and what it's like to write a book about events that happened more than 40 years ago. We talk about writing and reading travel stories that are about movement versus stories that are about staying still and getting to know one place and culture. We talk about why so much travel writing is ephemeral and what qualities make a traveler more likely to write stories that last over time. We talk about the fate of travel writing and publishing in the United States, a place which doesn't always have a sense for the world beyond its borders. We start by talking about how nonfiction memoir books tend to be limited in theme and not all that international in scope, even as they are popular in bookstores. Let's listen in.
I was reading reviews of memoirs all the time, and they seem to be all of kind of the same. There seemed to be like five distinct topics. There was abuse, addiction, dysfunction, illness, and grief. And, you know, there's a term for these memoirs, misery memoirs. And these are all obviously very important subjects, and great books have been written about them. But I thought there was room for memoirs that, for one, kind of engaged with the world. All these memoirs are very focused on the author and the problem that that author experienced. And so I wanted a memoir that engaged with the world and also a slightly more optimistic, upbeat memoir. And that's what mine is. I hope that's what you found when you read it.
It occurs to me that there's nonfiction books go through different phases, and you allude to the travel writing boom of the 1980s when travel writing became fashionable. It occurs to me that a certain kind of trauma memoir became fashionable one decade later in the 1990s. I'm not as versed in what the memoir market is like now. Is it still sort of trauma oriented? Did you study the market of what memoirs look like these days?
I definitely did. As I said, I always check the reviews, Sunday in the New York Times and other places to see what kind of memoirs they're publishing. As soon as I started looking for a publisher for this, I was being told that memoirs were kind of falling out of fashion now, which is exactly what I'd been told about travel books when I started peddling around my travel books. So I'm always kind of a little late. The misery memoir is not as prominent as it was once, but it's still, you'll still see a fair number of them, definitely. But now you're seeing, you're seeing all kinds now. Thankfully, there's a little more variety when it comes to memoirs.
Well, why don't you take us from your early, from your youth, when you were maybe trying to figure out what you wanted to do in life, to this rather slow entry into travel writing. And it occurs to me one parallel that we both have is expatriate life, that before we had our proper bylines, you lived for a while in Poland. I lived for quite a while in South Korea. And that sort of formed me. So how did this journey begin and flesh out for you?
I'd say it began a year after I got out of college. I was working at a horrible job, a boring job in Washington, D.C. kind of editing engineering reports for the Navy Department. And one day I was on my lunch break reading Esquire magazine. And there was an article in the Esquire on how to live cheaply in France for a year. And the trick was to become a student. The author said that, you know, room and board, tuition was cheap, covered room and board. You lived in a dorm, but you lived in France. And you did it very, very cheaply. And I had this idea that I wanted to be a travel writer. And I thought, well, in that case, I probably should learn another language. And I'd studied French in school. So I did. I went to France for a year. I studied in Aix-en-Provence for 7 or 9 months during the school year. And when school got out in June, my French was just getting to be functional. And I thought, if I go home, I'm going to forget it. So I packed my suitcase and went to Alsace, which is about as far as you can get from Provence, if not geographically, at least culturally. And I found a job on a farm for the summer. And that turned out to be a great experience. The family had a son who was my age. And my French got really pretty good. And, you know, I came home from that experience, and that was the first, you know, being away from home, living in another culture, learning the language, learning the ways of the people. And that kind of whetted my appetite for foreign experience. And I came back to New Jersey. I looked for a newspaper job. I went one day to the Trenton Times. And I wasn't even allowed to see anybody. They just handed me a job application. And I said, well, there's no reason to play this straight. And the first question was, what was your last employment? So I said, you know, working on a farm. And they asked, what were your duties? And I said, picking cherries, baling hay, milking cows. And they said, why'd you leave your last employment? And I said, I got tired of stepping in cow shit. I just made a joke of it and went home thinking, well, that's that. And the next day, the feature editor called me, said she wanted me to come in for an interview. Turns out the editor of the newspaper was so impressed by my job application that he hung it on a wall in the newsroom. So I went down for an interview. They didn't hire me right away because they rarely hired people with no newspaper experience. The Trenton Times then was owned by the Washington Post, and it was used as a kind of farm club. So there were a lot of bright, young, ambitious journalists working there at the time. But I had a 3-month trial. I got a job as I said, a feature writer, and that's kind of how my writing career began. Working there at the Trenton Times, and the atmosphere, as you can imagine, was really quite exciting. Everybody was enthused about journalism. This was just a few years after Watergate, again, and we were working for a Washington Post-owned newspaper. Many of the people I worked with went on to the Post and on to great things, like David Marinus, who's written biographies of Jim Thorpe and Roberto Clemente and Vince Lombardi and Barack Obama and others. So, it was a great... That's how it began, but, you know, it still wasn't travel writing. And while I was in Trenton, a woman who I'd met on my way home from France came from Poland, and we fell in love. And she had to leave after 10 months, go back to her studies at the University of Warsaw. And I decided, what the hell, I'm going to quit the paper and go to Poland and see, you know, what it's like there. And because I was very much in love as well, but I also thought it could be good for my career.
And so how much of a percentage was that? Love versus travel writer ambition?
Yeah, it's high in the love quotient. I'd say about 80% with love. I just didn't want to lose this woman. I'm pursuing her, but yeah, okay. It'll be good for my career as well.
And so what year was this?
That was 1978 that I left the Trenton Times and moved to Warsaw. And yeah. I got a job teaching English at a really, a very venerable English Language College in the heart of Warsaw that had been founded in 1921 by a group of American Methodists. It was called the Methodist School, even though it had nothing to do with religion. It just taught English. And I worked there for 6 months, and my visa expired. I had a six-month work visa. And when I went to ask for an extension, I was asked to become an informer. They said, you know, basically, if you help us, we'll help you. And that was a bit of a shock. It certainly gave me a taste of life in the socialist system. And I obviously declined, and I had to leave Poland within the next 3 days because my visa was about to expire.
Right. So it's interesting, like there's a whole generation of Americans that don't think of Poland as a place that has informants, but it was very much of its time. 1978 is an interesting time in history to move to Poland. And so how did you end up finagling your way back to Poland, and what was happening there at the time?
Well, I went to Greece. I took a series of trains from Warsaw, overnight trains from Warsaw to Budapest, Budapest to Bucharest, Bucharest to Sofia, Sofia to Athens, because I had a friend from Aix-en-Provence. We'd both been in French language class together, living in Athens. And I thought I can stay with him and he'll maybe help me find a job. And I found a job teaching English, but not in Athens, in the north of Greece, for 4 months. And, you know, I just went one day, I guess, in April, I went to Athens to the Polish embassy and applied for a visa, thinking there's no way I'm going to get a visa, considering what just happened to me in Warsaw. And I got a tourist visa for 2 weeks in June with no problem. Thank God there was no internet back then, and communication between the visa office in Warsaw and the consulate in Athens was not the best. So yeah, I had no trouble getting a visa to go back as a tourist. And that happened to coincide, that week, the first week I was back, coincided with Pope John Paul II's first return to Poland as Pope. And that was an incredible time. His mass on the main square in Warsaw was something I'll never forget. And to me, that was really the impetus. That was the seed from which the whole solidarity movement began, because you had thousands of Poles gathered on this main square of their capital, professing beliefs at odds with their governments. And it was a kind of silent protest. And they saw the strength. They saw the strength in numbers. And they realized that, you know, they could do something. They could push back against the government. And they did 16 months later with Solidarity.
Now, you recall this time in quite intensive detail. Were you taking lots of notes, taking lots of journals? How did you remember all of the sensory details as well as the big historical strokes of this time in Poland?
I did keep a journal. I'd been keeping a journal since college. In Poland, it became a diary, because especially when martial law was declared, Solidarity lasted for 16 months. And then on December 13, 1981, Polish tanks took to the streets and Solidarity's leaders were rounded up and martial law was in force. And from that day, the journal just became a diary. Everything just became so... Life became so intense. Everything was wrought with meaning, and so many interesting and also horrific things were happening that, yeah, I wrote a lot. And I, at the end of my 2 years, I had two thick loose leaf notebooks of journals and diaries. Now, when I wrote the book, the memoir, I didn't have the journals. And then we had some guests coming, and I had to clean out our storage unit here, and I found the notebooks. And that was perfect, because I could go back and add details, the things I'd written about. I could add things I'd completely forgotten about, but were in my journals. But the voice was still the same. It wasn't the voice of the the young, the 30 or 28 or 29 year old who'd written the journals. It was a more mature voice, and that didn't change, but the journals allowed me to add a lot of that detail.
It occurs to me that this memoir is looking back across decades. And Patrick Lee Fermor, who actually you introduced me to when I interviewed you years and years ago, is also known for writing a time of gifts looking back across decades. And so, right. I mean, was he an inspiration? What was it like sort of trying to recreate this youthful time that was actually a long time ago?
It's funny. Yeah, he is definitely an inspiration for me. In the memoir, I describe how enchanted I became with that book. His writing was this really kind of slightly high-flown, very kind of Baroque style that I really liked. And it kind of married youthful enthusiasm with this rigorous learning, which obviously came much later in his life. But because, as you say, he wrote this book many years after he did the walk. So he was able to combine those two elements. So yeah, he's definitely a huge influence of mine. The big difference is that he's writing about a journey. You know, he's moving from place to place. And my memoir is each chapter is about a place where I lived. I would, and that's kind of the way you traveled, I think, where I would just go to a place and settle for a while and try to get to know it. You know, France and then Poland and then Greece and then Poland again. But also what I loved is that in that first book, A Time of Gifts, he's writing about a part of Europe that most travel writers ignore, you know, Northern Europe. And that was the Europe I found myself in. And that too was an inspiration to try to write interestingly of this place that not that many people think of as a travel writer's subject.
You note in your memoir that like a lot of these American newspapers are curiously incurious about the rest of the world, that you came back, I think it was maybe the Philly Inquirer had detailed descriptions about Philadelphia Phillies loss, and then almost nothing, you know, about these very momentous things that were happening in Europe. So even as the travel sections were not impressed with Poland, it seemed like the front pages weren't really as international as they could be either.
Yeah, in Philadelphia, I went to the Inquirer to try to get a job. And, you know, they told me I needed at least 5 years of experience to even be considered for a newspaper job. I'd only been at the Trenton Times for a year and a half. And, yeah, the fact that I'd been living abroad, especially in Poland during this momentous time, I'd been writing about it, that really meant nothing to them. And that fall, Lech Walesa was going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. And the next day's Philadelphia Inquirer had four columns to the story about the Phillies' loss to the, I think it was the L.A. Dodgers in the National League playoffs, and just one or two columns to Lech Walesa's getting the Nobel Prize. I wrote them a letter to the editor that they published, but they didn't hire me.
I think we've come into an interesting texture here, which is just the idea of what is travel writing and where can one find it? Because there's not a real sense for international news in newspapers. Of course, now we live in this algorithm-driven age that is even more baffling. But then you have the newspaper travel sections that you do see are often very consumer slanted, and they're about, you know, sexier, more high traffic destinations and where to go and what to eat and things like that. And in fact, one of the things that put you on my radar was this idea about how bland a New York Times travel story could be, how prim and uninterested it was. And so I guess, and I don't know if I know the answer to this, but where is travel writing and where can it exist if the Inquirer in the 1980s is giving more word count to baseball games and international events, and the New York Times travel section is sort of doing a glitzy consumer information iteration of what it's like to travel the world?
You know, when I was starting out, there was a kind of accepted progression. You started maybe writing it for newspapers, then graduated to magazines, you developed some clips, and then eventually you wrote a book. These days, you know, people just write a book without any of that preliminary stuff. So, you know, there are book travel books that are still coming out, but it's more like, you know, dribs and drabs. It's not a constant flow of them like there was in the 80s. 80s, you know, was the heyday of travel writing.
Yeah, I was a teenager during that heyday, and I had an outside magazine subscription where I really came to love the writing of Tim Cahill, and you know, I discovered Eddie Harris and Paul Theroux and Jan Morris and other people when I was quite young. But
they inspired you. They made you think this would be a fun thing to do, right?
Absolutely, but in a strange way, it felt like it didn't quite apply to me. You know, like I'm trying to think if it would be harder or easier for someone who's 17 right now to eventually get into travel writing. Just because, like, one of my literary heroes was Dave Barry. If you remember Dave Barry, he was a humorist.
He's down here in Florida. Yeah.
And so in my school newspaper, I sort of wrote funny articles. I didn't have a passport. I lived in Kansas. I didn't realize that you could really give yourself permission to travel. And I think that a lot of the philosophy of my first book, Vagabonding, is about giving yourself that permission. And so it's funny that as I was being inspired by those writers during the heyday of travel writing, I still felt that it didn't quite apply to me. And I felt like maybe I still, you know, that progression you talked about, newspapers and then magazines and then books. Well, by the time I did my expatriate stint, online magazines had become a thing, and I was able to get my first byline from across the ocean. I just sent an email to this guy named Don George, who later published, who really was instrumental in getting my career started. So I'm wondering, was there ever a normal in travel writing? Because it seems like you started at a pretty good age. I started at a pretty good age. But you mentioned Holiday Magazine, which sort of, after the war, sort of reinvented what a travel magazine could be. And it occurs to me that before the war, there wasn't really a middle class that would consume travel writing per se, that maybe the travel writing was mixed in with other high-minded intellectual magazines that appealed to people who had the money to travel. So you're sort of a historian and scholar of travel writing itself. Was there a normal, or are we always fighting on this treadmill of changing media?
Well, I think it's the latter. I mean, I thought in the 80s that was the normal, right? I was still kind of starting out, but I saw all these, I saw this kind of just renaissance of travel and this flow of excellent writers. I mean, Paul Theroux, Bruce Chatwin, Jonathan Rabin, Sarah Wheeler, all these people coming on the scene, writing these wonderful books. And I thought that was the norm. I thought that's the way, this is a great time to become a travel writer. This is the way it's going to go. And it didn't. It just kind of, it faded away. I mean, some people still can sell travel books. Paul Theroux does. Bill Bryson does. And, you know, to broaden our perspective here, England still does a good job with travel writing. Granta magazine, which in the 80s used to do entire issues devoted to travel writing, still does a fair amount of travel writing. And Rolf, I just came back from Poland. I was in Poland last month, and it's so exciting. You walk into a bookstore, pretty much any bookstore in Warsaw, and there's an entire section devoted to books of what they call travel and reportage. Mm-hmm. And you see English language authors translated into Polish. You see Polish writers. It's a big thing in Poland. And It was heartening to see, and I wish that were the case here in the States.
Well, I just came back from Kenya, and it was interesting to see, you know, just I would call it an emergent middle class, but I haven't traveled in Kenya enough to really know how much backstory the middle class has. But I just interacted with a lot of middle class Kenyans who traveled a ton. Like even the guy who cut my hair at the barbershop, he's been to Uganda. They sort of have this party town where young Kenyans can go and sort of let off some steam. I met other people who'd been to Ethiopia on business and some people who'd done some overland travels into the southern part of Africa. So I wonder, I wonder if America might just be this anomalously incurious country where we just don't have the same appetite for travel that other places do. But also maybe different media forms. I know that a lot of the Kenyans I met, they don't have any books, but they do a lot of tell a lot of travel stories on Instagram, for example. I just wonder if these new media might sort of diversify what is considered travel writing. Do you have any sense for that?
It's definitely changed, and people are going to more visual experiences through Instagram, TikTok, things like that, I guess. But it's not something I follow that avidly. I'm a word person. I just love language. I love the way people can describe places. And that's what appeals to me.
What does a travel writer bring to the impression of a place that a local person can't bring? You've written about Poland, but you're also married to a Polish woman. And so I'm just curious what perspective, I mean, this probably goes to the core of travel writing. What perspectives do travelers have to bring from a place as opposed to just reading a novel or a memoir by a person from that place?
A fresh eye. Even as you and I did, living in places, after a while, we got a little jaded. Everything started to look normal to us, even in Korea, right? And even in Poland, things start. A perfect example of that, a wonderful travel writer was a guy named P.J. O'Rourke. Have you ever read him?
Yeah, Holidays in Hell.
Yeah. Yeah, he wrote about Korea there, and he also wrote about Poland. And I came back from Poland, and I picked up that book in a bookstore, and I remember turning to his chapter on Poland kind of cynically and thinking, yeah, what's he going to tell me? And I stood there for the next 35 minutes just in awe of the way he captured Poland. He'd just flown into Poland with no Polish and really captured the place. And he described things that had come to me had become normal, but through his fresh eyes, it came, I saw them in all their absurdity. So that's a perfect example of what the traveler can bring to a place that the local, just kind of takes for granted. I think travelers can bring so much. And I just wish there were more readers to appreciate that.
P.J. O'Rourke is an interesting case, just because he was funny. He wrote funny stories, but he was also politically conservative and made no secret of that. And often wrote for some not sort of populist conservative magazines, but sort of suspenders wearing 1980s conservative publications. Yeah. So what do you think? What do you think it takes? What do the likes of P.J. O'Rourke or other people who can make you see a place that you thought you knew in a fresh way? What is the energy that is required of a travel writer like that, regardless of their background or political affiliation? What inner spirit allows you to see?
I think a certain degree of openness. And yeah, I mean, his politics aside, I did find that as a traveler, he was pretty open to the culture and the sense of the place that he was in. I mean, I've always said that the obvious quality in a good travel writer, first of all, is curiosity. You have to be curious. I always ask a lot of questions when I travel. I just even here at home, I mean, I live in a place where, I live in South Florida. You go to a restaurant and invariably your waiter has an accent, even maybe a kind of an American accent, but it's not, you can tell they're not from here because most people are not from here. And I always ask people where they're from. I'm always curious. Curiosity is really important. One of my favorite travel writers, and I probably one of yours too, is Colin Thubrin. Every year I have this secret hope that he wins the Nobel Prize, but probably will not happen. But what I admire so much about Thubrin is that he has empathy. You know, he has this warm heart that he's able to empathize with the people he meets. But at the same time, he has this really brilliant mind that allows him to analyze the places he's seeing as well. So that combination of the openness and the analytical spirit is just a formidable combination in a travel writer. And then, of course, just the have that talent to write in just beautiful, lucid prose is another thing. And you mentioned about O'Rourke, you know, his sense of humor. I really value humor in anything I read. And humor is built on the element of surprise. And nothing is more surprising, really, than travel. You know, we have so many ways to experience a place before we go there that we sometimes think that, you know, we're not going to really have any sense of discovery when we get there, but we're always surprised by what we find, no matter where we go and no matter how much we've read about it. Paul Theroux has a great line in The Pillars of Hercules, you know, where he's traveling the Mediterranean and he's going to some countries that have been written to death, you know, Spain and France and Greece. And at one point he says, nobody's ever described the place where I've just arrived.
Hmm.
You know, that's so true.
Right. Yeah. In the temporal sense, I think one thing that travel writing can do is sort of peel back some of the cliches of how we consume the world. Because one thing I still remember about Holidays in Hell, the P.G. O'Rourke book that I read more than maybe at least 25 years ago, is he sort of talks about the generalized language with which we talk about a place like India, just sort of this mass of humanity. And he pointed out that the population density is actually much thicker in the Netherlands, but we never use these same...
That's great.
We never use these same, you know, cliches about the clustered humanity of the Netherlands. And so here's a guy who was, you know, politically conservative, but he wasn't taking cheap shots, that he was taking a cheap shot at the way that the media depicted India, that it was a lazy generalization that media had. So it feels like if somehow we can create an interest in people writing that travel writing, one of the missions of travel writing is to sort of poke fun at the cliches that the headlines bring us about the rest of the world.
Yes, that's so true. And here's the other thing I admired about P.G. O'Rourke, that he was funny. He'd make you laugh, but his humor also illustrated an interesting aspect. You know, it was humorous, but also it was telling. It was getting a point across by making you laugh at the same time, which is a real talent. I mean, there are a lot of people who just make you laugh, but his had a higher purpose.
Keeping in mind that how technology has changed, not just between now and the time when you started, but even from the time that I started, it was a more technologically complicated world than the one that you started 20 years before me. What advice would you give to young writers now who want to mix the human texture of travel into a narrative? You know, maybe they want to mix their falling in love with a place or a person with their sense for what is happening in the historical moment and their personal experience and their experience of place, their honest experience of another place. Amid all this technological change, what hasn't changed and what tools can a writer still bring as they aspire to write about travel?
I would recommend doing what I did, going to a place alone where you don't speak the language and just settling there for a year or two and just getting to know the place, the language, the people. And you know, if you're lucky, you'll have the good fortune, as I did, to be in a place where a lot is happening in terms of news and current events. But it doesn't have to be that. It doesn't have to happen. You can just go to an interesting part of the world and just make it your own, you know, get some specialty And then, you know, later you can write about any place, but you always have that one place that you know better than most people. And that can be your main subject.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Thomas Swick's new book, Falling Into Place, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.